afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of November 8th, 2015. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. We've got a great one lined up for this week because we have two of my favorite panel members joining us here today. I want to remind everyone that if you're here with us live, we do have the live online conversation going on around the show. If you're listening to this in streaming format on demand, well, thanks very much. We appreciate that. But please think about joining us on Friday afternoons at 3 p.m. because we do have that great conversation. We'd love to have you as a part of that. Well, I mentioned a great panel. Let's introduce them to you. First, from over at Dark Reading, we have Dark Reading Senior Editor Sarah Peters joining us. Sarah, welcome to Information Week Live.
Thank you, Kurt. I'm happy to be here.
And we also have Executive Editor for Community at Information Week, Dave Wagner, sitting around the table with us. Dave, we're glad to have you here today.
Thanks, Kurt.
Now, I always ask my panelists what they want to talk about, what big stories they brought to the show. I know that Sarah's got one, and just before we went on the air, Dave, you started talking about a story from Paris. So I'm assuming that this has to do with computers being loved or being used either for very romantic purposes or to make truly flaky pastries.
Well, something definitely went flaky, but that wasn't what I think they were going for. It broke today, although there was some news of it last week as well, but it really started hitting the news today that the Paris airport had a major shutdown on Saturday. And the reason is that a system that they use when the weather is bad, and I stress that, when the weather is bad, so pilots need to rely on this to land safely, just keep that in your mind when I tell you what was going on, went down because of a glitch in Windows 3.1.
What?
Windows 3.1, as you may remember, came out in 1992 when I was listening to Pearl Jam wearing flannel. I don't want to talk about that. the Paris airport, Orly, has, in fact, four different operating systems running programs of different legacies, different ages. And a glitch in Windows 3.1 brought this one down. I found that particularly amusing, given how old it was. I heard that the program was also running Logo, and it was that darn turtle that ruined the whole thing, but I can't swear to that part. But yes, we are relying, our airports are relying on something to land planes safely in bad weather on a operating system that is old enough to drink.
Well, now,
and not
I wonder if this means that they're finally going to get around to doing that big Windows 95 update.
Well, we can all hope they go to Vista, Kurt. And my big thing about that is not only are we relying on an ancient technology there, but I suspect that that makes it, I don't know if that makes it more or less vulnerable to security issues, actually. Maybe Sarah can talk about that. But it seems to me that, you know, Microsoft hasn't supported Windows 3.1 for, I believe it's 14 years. They're clearly not patching it. That would be a little insane. So does that make it more vulnerable, or is it so ancient that nobody would even bother at this point?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I would assume that lots of people would disagree on it. Everybody would probably come at it with a different viewpoint. But what I can tell you is that oftentimes people think that a problem is no longer pertinent because it just it's so old that they figure nobody will bother with it anymore. And then you find out, oh, wait, somebody does actually still use that system. And, oh, wait, that piece of code is still in existence somewhere. And then somebody says, hey, why not exploit it? And what it really comes down to is just the question of, is there a reason? Does somebody have a good reason to exploit something? And if somebody has a compelling reason to do it, and it can be done, then it shall be done. A lot of systems, a lot of control systems, a lot of industrial systems, as you guys know, tend to update things way later than they probably should because they're so afraid of things failing. You know, they say, well, we know this works, so let's not mess with it. And then they just keep doing that for 20 or 30 years. If you're dealing with an attacker who's just going for money, then they're generally going to go after whatever applications are in use by the most people, right? They're going to go for the most bang for their buck, and a system that's being used only in French airports in bad weather is not something that's necessarily gives them the most bang for their buck if they are a financially motivated attacker. But if somebody is specifically trying to do exactly that, then it's a big problem that they're using a system that nobody is going to help them patch and secure. So it really depends on which way you look at it and what you consider your risks to be.
Right. Well, I would think that a nation's air traffic is probably still a legitimate target, unfortunately.
I would agree. If I was on that plane, I'd be thinking, now I'm going to be thinking about it. Thanks a lot, Dave. I gave you nightmares about ransomware last week.
Yeah.
Now you're going to give me nightmares about Windows 3.1 on, you know, on air traffic control nightmares
right.
This week.
Oh, it seems only fair. I would also just like to point out for fun that the most probably long-lived legacy of Windows 3.1 is that it was the first Windows that included Minesweeper. So so if you're still playing Minesweeper, you've been playing it as long as the Paris airport has been.
That is a great game.
Land plane.
Classic.
Well, and it makes me wonder whether they were running Windows 3.1 or the immediately superior Windows for Workgroups 3.11, which was the first Windows to have decent networking as part of it. That would make a difference, but not a very big one at this point. This really is a scary kind of thing because, well, among other things, it lets us know the age of a lot of the hardware that they have to be using, because there are all kinds of newish pieces of flight control software that wouldn't run on Windows 3.1. There are all kinds of embedded systems that aren't going to be able to talk to the network stack that exists for Windows 3.1. So there are just tons and tons of implications to a piece of news like this.
Right. Well, and you know, the sad truth is that there are a lot of airports I still go into as a business traveler where I see before a flight takes off, a gate agent will print out a manifest on a printer that is older than possibly I am, that still uses the paper where you have to tear off the little sides that have the holes in them, and they hand that physical manifest to a flight attendant or another crew member before the flight takes off. So you know that this is not isolated to the Paris airport either. There, we have those kinds of legacy systems, including just something as simple as a printer, all over the world in our airlines.
No, you're absolutely right. I think that airports are one of the last big installations for 24-pin impact printers. It really is astounding, as you say. And I guess to Sarah's point, this is one of those things where they do have hardware that's working. They do have software that's working. Why would they want to mess with it, especially when we tend to get things like the very public incidents that United went through not long ago, where they did an update and it brought their entire passenger manifest system down. But there are still issues. I mean, computers do have lifespans, and it does make sense that we want people who are able to keep up with what they're doing. And I'm not sure how many current Windows 3.1 certifications Microsoft is passing out.
Well,
go ahead.
If anybody has one right now, sort of left over, I would dust it off and I would call Paris. They make a lot of money. Windows 3.1 may be the next Fortran.
Fascinating.
Well,
terrifying. Fascinating.
Terrifying, fascinating. I'm sure that there's going to be more on this kind of thing, because we know, even though we don't have confirmation, we just know intuitively that there are other airports out there doing the same sort of thing, and that, frankly, there are other kinds of industries doing the same sort of thing. So this is going to be the sort of story that we keep. And now that we're sort of primed to be frightened, Sarah, you mentioned when we were talking about you being on the show today that something specific you wanted to talk about. And if it's something specific you want to talk about, I have to believe it's very, very frightening indeed.
Well, I find it frightening, but I find it pretty kind of exciting and fascinating. And that might be just because I've been covering security for too long, and that there's something vastly and terribly wrong with me at this point. So I'll let you be the judge when I tell you about this particular story. Last year, JPMorgan Chase experienced a giant data breach, which resulted in the theft of about 80 million customers' data. And we knew that already. But an indictment was unsealed this week that told us a whole bunch of new stuff that we didn't know. Three men were indicted. It was a 23-count indictment. And among the charges were not just hacking, but also securities fraud, wire fraud, identity theft, illegal internet gambling, conspiring to commit money laundering. And when you add up all of the charges, one of the men alone, his charges add up to over 200 years in prison if you gave him the max sentence for everything. And what's interesting about it is really that hacking was at the center of what the Department of Justice described as a diversified criminal conglomerate. So basically they've got their fingers in all kinds of little criminal endeavors, and like a mafia would, and they're using cybercrime as a way to enhance all of these different criminal endeavors. So for example, when they stole all of that customer data from JPMorgan Chase, and it wasn't just JPMorgan, it was eight other businesses operating within the financial services industry. They then took all of that data and marketed certain stocks to all of those customer lists. And the goal was to manipulate the price, to artificially manipulate the price of those stocks. So that's fraud. And this was basically signaling, the way they put it was, it's signaling the next frontier in securities fraud. And this generated hundreds of millions of dollars in illicit proceeds. And in addition to that, they owned and operated an illegal internet gambling business and hacked into two software companies that they used for the gambling business. And they got into the email accounts of the executives at these software companies and were digging through the execs' emails to find out if they were doing anything that would give the illegal gambling business's competitors a leg up. They were basically trying to do corporate espionage on behalf of their, you know, gambling business by using cybercrime to do it. And then, what was the other one? They were also running an illegal payment processor. They had two payment processors for which they were processing payments for illegal businesses and then taking cuts of those illegal businesses' payments. So illegal pharmaceutical suppliers, malware distributors, other online casinos that were illegal. So they're processing payments, getting a little taste of all of these other illegal businesses, and then hacked into a regulatory organization or like a risk and compliance organization to root around there and find out how they do their monitoring to find so that they could keep from being, so they knew the most up-to-date ways that they detected fraudulent and suspicious behavior so that they could make sure that their own payment processors' illegal and illicit activity wouldn't be detected. So all, you know, just a whole bunch of illegal activity, all using hacking in one way or another to protect themselves or to support their endeavors. And we've never really seen anything quite like it before.
That's awesome. They're a laundry and a concrete firm away from being the Sopranos.
Exactly. Exactly.
So how did they get caught? So what was their mistake?
That's exactly what we don't know right now. And everybody's wanting to know more. And none of us have the answers yet, but I'm digging into it. And one of my hopes for next week is to do another story on this topic. And just, you know, the way that cybercrime is investigated now, it's not just one individual office. They have to operate with the SEC. In addition, I don't mean SEC like, you know, in football. I mean the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. And also, you know, so it's the FBI and it's all of, and it's Interpol and it's the SEC and it's all of these different, you know, and it's the Secret Service and it's just a whole bunch of different organizations. And maybe now the Gambling Commission has to be involved. And what I want to dig into is just how many different organizations now need to be involved so that maybe you do have to have your vice squad and your cybercrime squad paying a lot more attention to each other than maybe they did in the past. You know, your vice, your financial fraud, your cybercrime, and all of these other guys who might have only been kind of tangentially related to each other now are dealing with the same criminals, even if it's not the same. Sometimes it's the same crime, or sometimes it's completely different crimes, but it's the same ringleaders of these giant criminal enterprises.
Right. Well, you know, we you know, we've been saying for, what, I guess 5 years or now, that every company is a technology company. I think
yeah.
it shows that every criminal is a cyber criminal.
That's exactly how I was thinking of it. I didn't put this in the story that I wrote about it, but I was thinking of how, you know, we always have been saying to CIOs over the past however many years how, you know, IT drives business. It doesn't just support businesses anymore. It drives businesses. And here we go. It apparently drives crime as well.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool.
And you know, what's frightening is I totally get why you're saying that you're excited about this as opposed to frightened by it.
I
because
know.
Because there's something to be said for the idea that here are people applying technology to transform a business, and that's what we talk about at Information Week. You know, we like to talk about it from the good side, but the truth is this is an elegant display of somebody being the CIO of the mafia. It's fantastic.
I know. And the one of these people, there are two Israeli citizens who were arrested, and the big mastermind, the ringleader, he is one of those, and he was arrested. The U.S. citizen, he's still at large, so he is on the, I think he's now on the most wanted list, and he's out there someplace. They think he's out in Eastern Europe someplace.
Well,
so
I'm ready to write the script for the movie. You and me will collaborate.
I know. If you see Joshua Samuel Aaron, you can first congratulate him on his fine work and then report him to the authorities. Then ask him for the rights to his story
right.
so you can write a Hollywood picture about it.
So
you've got a lot to talk to.
So the really funny thing about that is big data and analytics helps pharmaceuticals enough, he may actually live the 200 years to get out of prison and do it all over again.
That would, you know, if anybody could do it, it would be these guys, because we know that they really know what they're doing when it comes to, well, but I mean, this, some of the activity started as far back as 2007. And then the financial services and securities fraud thing, that started back in 2012. So it's a pretty good run, but I'm sure that it wasn't as long of a run as they would have wanted to. So we'll see if they manage to evade. I'm gonna doubt he gets 200 years, but I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen that many, that kind of pile of charges against anybody for cybercrime before.
Well, it's interesting because we've seen large tech companies make meteoric rises in revenue, right? Like a Google, right? But usually it takes much longer for a crime syndicate to build from nothing to that. So it's fascinating. Not only is technology helping to change crime, but it's actually helping it, like, grow that same hockey stick that we saw Google grow with their revenue. It's the similarities are pretty stunning, really.
Yeah, you're kind of making me think, like, maybe I should stop being such an honest citizen.
Honesty is always the best policy. Keep telling yourself that.
Yeah, hundreds of millions of dollars does sort of make me think about that. 200 years in prison or hundreds of millions of dollars, it's a tough one.
It depends on how long you get to hundreds of millions before you go to prison, right?
Right. That's really what it comes down to.
You brought up an interesting thing, which is you said that it was a pretty long run, but I'm sure they wanted it to be longer. Do we have any data or sense of sort of how long the career of a black hat hacker is? You know, it seems like a business you can stay in a long time if you don't get caught, and we're not catching them fast enough. Was this a long run or was it a short run?
That's an excellent question, and I don't have data on it.
Fair enough.
So I can't really comment on it, but I can tell you that most of the people who get convicted or charged with cybercrime are generally young, in their 20s and early 30s.
Right. And
in fact, for the people who are just charged or who were arrested for the TalkTalk breach last month were teenagers. But the big boys are 20s and 30s. So they couldn't have particularly long careers, but I'm sure that there are people of more advanced ages out there,
right,
who are
continuing
the good fight.
It's like Ocean's 11, right? It's you either get caught early or you get to retire on your big score.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, it sounds like this one is going to keep going for a while. Let us know what happens if these people are caught, and if the criminal in question does indeed get 200 years in prison. Keep us posted on this one, because you're right. This does have many fascinating aspects to it. No question about that.
I will.
Speaking of fascinating aspects, we've come to the part of the program where we always turn across the virtual conference table to Dave, because it's time for him to bring us the geek. Dave, we've had a couple of interesting stories already. I can hardly wait to hear what the geek end is this week.
Well, actually, probably a lot of people have heard a little bit about this already. I'm going to take a humorous stab at the Google car getting pulled over for driving too slow, which I find to be just a wonderful story. But to add to that, there was also another fun viral thing about self-driving cars this week, which was that a Tesla owner, as you may know, Tesla has introduced some driver assist software. A Tesla driver has posted a dashboard camera video to YouTube basically saying, "This is the moment my Tesla tried to kill me." So the Tesla in question they crossed the double yellow line into the other side of the road while a person was driving, and he had to pull it back manually to keep from running into a car. So on one hand, we have Google cars driving so slow they can't possibly get into an accident. And on the other hand, we have Tesla cars driving on the highway so recklessly that they almost do. So I found that humorous enough to take a little stab at this week. But it's interesting because I think we're finally getting to the nitty-gritty on exactly the kind of social issues that are going to come up around a car, right? So the police officer in question, when he pulled over the Google car, claimed that he was doing it to learn from the drivers. Whether that's true or not, we won't really know. But he asked the drivers some questions. You know, Google cars still have a driver in them right now during the test phase, to learn more about the car, and then he warned them about driving too slow. Well, Google put in a post that the reason why their cars are driving slow is because they want them to appear friendly. They don't want a car zooming past people where they feel that they're in danger. Well, that makes sense on one level, but there is such a thing as driving too slow compared to the traffic around you is equally dangerous. If everybody who comes up behind you is expecting you to be driving at the pace the traffic around you is at, and they have to swerve or tap their brakes, it becomes a real problem. So what's fascinating to me about this is that Google probably learned more anthropologically about this than they probably have in the 90 years of driving data they have. They say 90 years because they have essentially that much data as if a person had been driving for 90 years. There's a lot to learn from that. They have to figure out how to fit in, because before we have a world where everybody is in self-driving cars, we're going to have a world where self-driving cars are sharing the road with people, and they have to understand how those people work. And I think this was a pretty interesting lesson. I don't think this was a minor deal. Although it was funny, it actually has some serious lessons too.
Well, I can say from two bits of experience that the too slow doesn't necessarily translate to friendly. Now, first, I live in Florida. There are all kinds of people who drive too slow, and we rarely say that they're doing it because they're so darn friendly. The other thing is I live near a very rural area, and it's not uncommon to be going to one of the small towns near us and end up behind a tractor on the road. And again, these don't go at the normal rate of speed. They're pretty slow. And while we all say, well, gee, it's necessary for them to move from field to field or place to place, no one says, oh, what a wonderful friendly gesture it is for this farmer to drive his Ollis Chalmers down the road at 14 miles an hour during morning rush. So it seems to me that there is a lot for Google to learn from these incidents and try to make the experience a little better for those both in and around the cars.
Right. Yeah, I think that's it. And, well, you know, there's so many facets to this, because the first time a Google car drives too fast and is in an accident, they'll face just as much wrath. So it's gonna be touchy. It's going to be hard to do this. And what's interesting to me is I feel like in the last couple of months, they've really been seeding the ground to a lot of other companies. Tesla getting their software out into the field for real drivers looked pretty impressive. I mean, a lot of the headlines were breathless about Tesla having self-driving cars on the road, when that's not exactly 100% accurate. They're really only intended for highway use right now, and they're expecting the driver to pay full attention. Ford just announced that they're testing a self-driving car. They join, you know, Renault and Nissan and so many other companies. You know, Uber seems to be making progress. There's all of a sudden a lot of competition. Six months ago, a year ago, if we just said self-driving car, the first thing that would come to mind would have been Google. At this point, they're competing with Apple and Uber and Tesla and a lot of traditional car companies. So it seems like even though they got a head start, they're not that far ahead in the race anymore.
You know, it's interesting because I do keep hearing different companies say that they are moving forward with self-driving cars in much the same way that we're seeing more and more companies say that they have electric vehicles on the horizon. I wonder at this point whether those two are going to converge at some point in about, 3 years, and all of a sudden we have a slew of self-driving electric vehicles that are coming onto the market, and sometime as we run up to 2020, we get we get this huge game-changing influx of vehicles.
You know, they're just, as cars get more computer systems in them, the security community keeps finding more ways to hack into them and do things with them that they shouldn't be able to do. It was just over the summer that I believe that it was a reporter from Wired who bravely sat in a car and let a couple of security researchers remotely start it and bring it up to 70 miles per hour before they stopped it. And it was a terrifying experiment to watch, but that is some of the things that can be done. They had to recall the car in order to make, there have been recalls done now to fix security vulnerabilities. That's where we are right now, just because of infotainment systems. There's people able to break out of infotainment systems to take control of the steering and the braking on cars. And those are cars that aren't meant to be self-driving. So I don't even drive right now, but I'm pretty sure that next time I buy a car, I'm going to buy some standard transmission 1980 piece of crap. And I'm going to be fine with that. Something small that I can just parallel park easily and not worry if anybody dents it when they parallel park poorly beside me. Because I just don't trust anything. Whether it makes me drive too slow or drive too fast, I don't want self-driving cars. I don't want to be in one. I don't want to be around one. Besides, if you're in the car, here's the thing. If I'm in the car, am I that lazy? I don't know. Then again, I don't have a driver's license, so maybe I should have a self-driving car so I can get places on my own.
Let me tell you the opposite side of that, which is that I'm looking forward to the day where I can put my children in the car, tell the car to drive them to school, and then drive back to me without me having to be in the vehicle.
No, I get that. I mean, I get being able to say, hey, car, come pick me up, and you don't have to worry. And go fetch my children and let me sit here and watch the rest of SportsCenter without having to worry about who needs to get picked up from soccer practice. I get that. I'm just saying I don't trust it.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Maybe this is a naive question, but barring somebody doing an active decision to hurt me or my family, like to do violence to me, mm-hmm. I'm less worried about somebody hacking my car because I don't see where they're making the money in it. What are they going to do, go get it washed 20 times and charge it to me? As long as my bank information isn't in my car, I don't put my bank information on my phone, which I think I'm the only person left in the world who can't pay for something with his phone. But I won't let my car pay for its own car wash or oil change. I'm going to be there with my own card to do that. Barring that, I'm not 100% sure I'm all that worried about somebody hacking my car. I don't see the value in learning to get it to drive away. I mean, they might steal it. They might have it drive to them. But that's what car insurance is for, right? You know, I guess I'm just not that worried about it.
Let me present you with the concept then of car ransomware. Particularly if you're in the car. Let's say that you're in the car and you're driving the car and somebody remotely takes charge of the car and says, pay me not anything terribly exorbitant, like ransomware, say it's $400. Pay me $400 and I'll let you take control of your car again.
Or I'll crash you off the cliff. Okay.
Yeah.
I'll buy that.
I
hate you security experts.
I'm not saying that it will happen.
The minute it can happen, somebody will do it. I believe you. That will happen.
If it's the kind of thing, it's the kind of thing that certainly, even if it's just pay me $50 so that you can actually use your GPS again. You know, it's stuff that doesn't necessarily need to be the same exact things that are done to your laptop now probably will be done to your car at some point because there are systems being thrown in there with reckless abandon without the same kind of security measures put in that there would be if it was going into a laptop or even a smartphone. And fortunately, there are efforts now being made. There's this whole Internet of Things security movement is putting this little bug in people's, you know, in people's ears, and the automotive industry is actually paying a lot of attention right now. They're getting on top of it, and they're recognizing that these are issues that they have to be aware of, and there's actually now an automotive cybersecurity. I think IBM started something that's specifically trying to focus on the automotive industry. They started that just over the summer. So there's movement there, and they should be keeping tabs on all of this. But it's legit. It would really be lousy to be stuck in the middle of nowhere wishing that you had your GPS and knowing that you have to pay somebody $200 to be able to use it.
Okay, you sold me.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm giving you more reasons to have nightmares about ransomware.
No, you sold me.
Two weeks in a row.
Yeah. Yep. But let me ask you this as a counter question, even though it scares the bejeebers out of me. One of the ways most people deal with threats to their computer is a sort of school of fish mentality, right? Well, they're 50 billion computers out there, why is mine going to be the one that gets taken, right?
Yes.
Does the Internet of Things make that schooling security make any more sense because there are more things, or is that still just burying our head in the sand?
I think always Everybody tends to have the same thought of, why would anybody bother with me? My information isn't important. I'm not important. Nobody bothers with me. I think that I end up thinking that myself. I'm like, there's nothing that I have that's important. But it's just that when you think of it, first of all, when you think of it in the aggregate, if you all of the Fitbits in the world have have enough data on them that there's a way to manipulate it if you have the will to do so. And somebody's going to do it. And there's a same thing with your smart meters, same thing with your security devices on your house. But the more stuff you have to steal, like let's say that you are a wealthier person in a wealthy neighborhood, the locks on your doors probably should be, you know, people are going to be more interested in when you're leaving if they're thinking, well, I know that Dave is not going to be home because I've been monitoring the devices in his, I've been able to monitor the devices in his house and when they're set to go on and off. So I know now the patterns of his movement without ever having been to his house. I've been able to monitor when he's going to be there and when he's not going to be there and when his neighbors are going to be there and when they're not going to be there. Based on that information, I know precisely what the best time is to walk right in and take his most wonderful and expensive things. That kind of stuff. It happens. It might not happen to you, but ransomware happens to millions of people. And
right.
They're very indiscriminate with that.
So it sounds like I should invest in junker cars from 1980 and before because they're going to go up in value as rich people buy them to avoid ransomware in their car. Well,
yes.
That's a nice strategy. I'll get right on that.
I recommend it.
Well, I'm afraid you're going to have plenty of time to get on that because we have come to the end of our time here for Information Week Live. It has been a great conversation. See, I promised that at the beginning, and we delivered on it today. So let that be a lesson to everyone who's listening. When we tell you we're going to have a great show, by golly, we're going to have a great show. And we're going to have a great week ahead of us. And we want to know what everyone around the table is going to be doing. So, Sarah, let's start with you. What do you have planned for the coming week, and how can people find out about it?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm planning on doing another story about these diversified criminal conglomerates using hacking at the core and how we can track them down. So that's going to be coming up sometime next week. You can find me, obviously, on darkreading.com and also on Twitter at Sarah Peters, no H in Sarah.
Thank you so much. We always appreciate you being here with us, and we will look forward to your coverage on Dark Reading. Dave, how about you? I know that you don't live just for the geek end. What do you have coming up for the next week?
Yeah, you're going to see shortly an article done about the Deloitte Global CIO study. That I think is pretty interesting. It shows the difference between what CIO priorities actually are and what those priorities would be if they had their choice, which I think is pretty fascinating. It shows the kinds of pressures they're on to get things done versus what they'd like to get done. I think it's very enlightening. And also I think I'll be doing something on a group that is using analytics, particularly cell phone records, to get a much more detailed map of poverty in order to help NGOs and governments get relief and aid to impoverished people, which I think should be really useful and really interesting.
Very cool. And how can we find you on the Tweety Pipes and other social media to keep up with what you're doing?
Sure. Find me at Twitter at GeekandDave, and you can also see me every day pretty much on Information Week and allanalytics.com as well.
Well, thanks for taking time out of that schedule to be with us today. Now, as for me, next week I'm going to be back on the road. I was actually on the road this week, Monday and Tuesday. I had to take a trip up to Boston to visit with SAP, the folks doing their JAM software. I've got a piece currently on Information Week about SAP JAM. And next week, going to be heading out again, the latter part of the week, I'm going to be down at FawcettCon in Orlando. FawcettCon deals with open source and free software. Just how deeply into free and open source are they? Well, Richard Stallman is going to be delivering one of the keynote addresses. So that should be fun. I will be covering doing lots of tweeting and periscoping about it. You can follow me on both of those at KG4GWA, and I will try to let folks know on Facebook and LinkedIn what's going on. For Sarah Peters, Dave Wagner, and me, thanks so much for listening. I'm Kurt Franklin. We appreciate being here with us. Look forward to having you with us again next week. Thanks for listening, everyone.